Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders.
Woohoo!
I'm Cleo Rochat, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Brian Ward and Sydney Engel. Say hi, Brian and Sydney.
Hello.
This is our now third installment of Fables from the Cribside, our show where we review and recap top insights from previous episodes of the show. But first, let's remind you about the show.
We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. Usually in this show, we interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
However, today, instead of a conversation with one expert guest, we're taking a look back at three of our prior episodes with a focus on some common pediatric GI disorders. We'll be doing a spaced repetition recap of top pearls about constipation, celiac disease, and reflux.
So without further ado, let's get to it.
Just like reflux, these episodes are coming right back up. wait, I got more. So let's dose it like Miralax and recap.
Oh, man, Brian.
Well, before we jump into some content, anyone have a pick of the week?
My pick of the week is going to go ahead and be the color of the year that was just nominated, peach fuzz.
I still don't think that's a color.
It's not peach. It's peach fuzz.
Peach is a color. Peach fuzz is a texture.
It's both.
Okay. I'll buy it.
We'll take it up with the fashionistas.
Sydney, what's your pick of the week?
My pediatric focused pick of the week is the Easy Peasy Straw Cup, which I recently bought for our 8-month-old, and it's a weighted cup with a straw, and it is, like, he thinks it's the best thing since sliced bread.
Wow.
Actually, he's never had sliced bread, so best thing ever.
Was this a Shark Tank episode?
I don't know. To be honest, I found it from a really great Instagram influencer she's a speech and language pathologist, and she was like, this is the best cup to get for your child, and I trusted her, and I think she was right.
Wow. That's good to know. Easy peasy.
All right. I think my pick of the week is cowboys, weirdly enough. I just finished a book, like a novel about cowboys. And then my wife and I are watching Yellowstone, which is not a pediatric show. It is like very not a pediatric show. But then I go into clinic today and one of my friends has these new cowboy boots and they're super, they got like rubber soles and like mesh and they're super athletic looking. So I think my pick of the week right now is cowboys, like across the board.
I thought that was going to be a sports reference, but
me too, to be
honest. No, I'm done with football. College football is over. I'm done with football.
How long before you buy your own cowboy boots?
Oh, negative 8 months.
Next episode, you're showing them off.
No, I like moved to Nashville. I was like, all right, cowboy boots. No reason to be wearing cowboy boots. I have no business pretending to be a cowboy, but that's what Nashville is. It's people pretending and it's fun.
That's so true.
I think that's enough of making fun of my shoes. Y'all want to get into some, I just use y'all. Do we want to jump into some content?
Let's do it. Should we start with reflux?
Yeah, let's follow the GI tract and start off with our reflux episode, which was episode number 75. Our amazing guest for this episode was Dr. Carlo DiLorenzo, and the producer was the fantastic Dr. Nick Lee. For these recaps, we kind of like to go through how one would think about the condition when they are seeing a patient. So what is the pathophysiology? What are the symptoms we're looking at? How do you diagnose? How do you treat? So thinking about that with regards to reflux, one of the first big takeaways that I had from this episode was just recognizing what the norms are when it comes to reflux. So in this case, not even pathophysiology as much as just the physiology. Babies, it's not even that babies have more reflux, it's just the esophagus is so much shorter. And so because of this, it's normal for a 3 to 4 month old to have like 4 episodes of regurgitation or vomiting per day.
I thought it was amazing that when comparing how much an infant is taking in to how much they weigh, a 4-ounce bottle in young infants is similar to an adult drinking a human, like a full gallon. So it makes sense. If I were to try to drink a full gallon, I'm sure I would vomit if I tried to do that in 10 minutes. And that's what an infant is doing.
Are we going to have a competition for that when you're wearing your cowboy boots on the next episode?
Oh, no, that sounds so terrible.
All right. So recognizing that a lot of these things are normal, let's talk a little bit about some of the symptoms that Dr. DiLorenzo was talking about, the symptoms that are suggestive that reflux is even the issue. Because one of the main things is parents will come in and say, oh, my child is having reflux. They're crying a whole lot. And one of the things that Dr. DiLorenzo pointed out is that there's actually no correlation between crying and even that arching movement that we're seeing and it being a sign of GERD with a D. So sorry, I should have mentioned this at the beginning. We were talking about the difference between GER or physiologic reflux and then GERD where it becomes a disorder. So there's no correlation between that crying and the arching and the disorder of reflux. And so that would never be an indication for starting acid suppression.
And that makes sense because he also said that milk reflux is not acidic. So it shouldn't be painful for these little babies.
So when we're talking about these symptoms, there's a couple of things that you would think about as being pink flags, is how we put it. Like there are a few red flag symptoms, but more you're going to see things that are pink flags. So if they are having regurgitation 2 to 3 hours after the feed, that is a little more concerning and suggestive that it's something going on beyond just physiologic reflux. Bilious vomiting was actually the only red flag that he mentioned. And then the blood streaking emesis. Well, of course, that's the sort of thing as someone who sees kids makes me incredibly nervous whenever anyone describes blood coming from anywhere other than a cut. He was saying that actually it's only a little bit concerning, that it really isn't even an indication to scope. It's just an indication that you probably do need to start a PPI.
Right. But like kind of in the context, I think you mentioned if you're seeing lots of blood, that's an emergency room. I'm still not sure how I'd react if I saw a baby in front of me have a little bit of blood. But this gives me some pause and makes me kind of check what I think truly scary reflux is versus what might be actually pretty normal.
Exactly. So I think in general, if I just reflect on this episode overall, it was a lot of like, okay, take a step back. Not that there aren't reasons to be scared, but there's a lot of things that you can think of as more normal, more reason to just kind of pause, try some simple interventions as a starting point. In terms of diagnosis, we actually really didn't talk that much about it. We did when we started to go down the rabbit hole of the more advanced treatments, the situations in which surgery might be necessary, which we're not going to really talk about on this recap one. But he did mention that the indication for doing an upper GI x-ray would really just be if you have reflux that doesn't resolve at that 12-month mark, because by that time when a kid is really getting the vast majority of their intake from solids, they shouldn't be having as much reflux. It should be going down. It should essentially be resolved. And furthermore, as the solids go up, the reflux should go down. So if it starts after the solids, that's also a concerning finding.
I always used to tell families that as your baby develops those abdominal muscles, that sphincter between the esophagus and stomach is also developing. What Dr. DiLorenzo brought up was that at the same time, babies are doing solids, like you said, Sydney, and then they're spending more time upright. They're seated when they're eating, they're feeding themselves. They're starting to be more ambulatory into their toddler years. And it kind of all fits together.
Exactly. So if we're thinking about to the point on what makes it easier for a child to digest, certainly one of the things that we can talk about is positioning. Getting beyond positioning to the treatment options that are easily and readily available, Dr. DiLorenzo essentially said we have 2 quick and easy options. The first is to just do smaller feeds to that gallon of milk analogy, just put less in them at a time. And the second is to make the feeds thicker, kind of give it more, for lack of a better way of describing it, give it a little bit more weight, a little bit more content. And so with regards to thickening options, he said that what he typically does is 1 teaspoon of rice or oat cereal per ounce. He was saying that a lot of guidelines will recommend more than that, but he prefers to start at that point. You can titrate up or down as needed. And that the main point of counseling around this is letting the parents know that it can cause harder stools. And one thing that he said that kind of makes a ton of sense to me, but I hadn't thought of before, is that this intervention should work immediately. With the first feed of doing a thicker feed, you should notice a decrease in reflux. And if you don't notice a decrease in the symptoms, that's almost indicative that maybe reflux isn't the issue at hand.
Yeah, totally. That was a really important learning point for me too. He also mentioned that for express breast milk, there's a special type of thickener called gel mix as the only really great option for thickening breast milk, which was interesting to me.
The other thing that I don't have experience with a lot is these AR formulas. And apparently they thicken only in an acidic environment. And so when you talk a little bit next, Sydney, about acid blockade, it's not useful to do an AR formula and acid blockade at the same time, because it's the acidity in the stomach that causes or activates that formula to thicken within the stomach.
Speaking of acid blockers, I think one, and this kind of feels like consistent through many of these different GI issues, but one of the big things was like, okay, so if that doesn't work, we go to acid blockers, right? And the answer is like, no, still don't go to acid blockers. If that doesn't work in most cases, supposing you don't have that blood-tinged emesis or reflux, Dr. DiLorenzo actually recommends as a next step, then you change the formula. And the reason for that is because the reflux could actually, rather than being a sign of something going on with the sphincter, it could be a sign of inflammation in the upper GI tract due to allergy, milk protein allergy. And so it's reasonable to say, let's do a trial of extensively hydrolyzed formula, or if a baby is exclusively breastfed or breastfed at all, having the mom do a cow's milk-free diet as the next step and see if that resolves the issue. Obviously, if there's bloody stool, that would point in the direction of an allergy. But in the absence of bloody stool, this is still a reasonable thing to try. The main consideration there is that unlike the thickening agents, this takes a little bit more time to work. You really need to do 2 to 3 weeks, because now rather than saying, oh, we're just dealing with reflux, you're trying to heal inflammation, which does take a little bit more time.
And if you're following these guidelines, you're doing the dietary changes and still struggling with reflux, Dr. DiLorenzo mentioned this may be a good time to talk to a pediatric gastroenterologist if you have one accessible nearby. Otherwise, at this point, he talks about starting or considering acid blockade. Sydney, do you want to talk a little bit about his recommendations there?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of the acid blocker, the two main options people think of are the PPIs and the histamine and the H2 receptor antagonists. And he was saying that he usually will do famotidine BID 0.5 mg per kg per dose rather than the PPI, just because it is available as a liquid. It doesn't have to be compounded. And he doesn't necessarily support using something as strong as a PPI unless absolutely needed, because leaving a little bit of that acid secretion has some evolutionary benefits to the child.
And then he suggested trying to stop after about a year and seeing how the patient does, and then talking to the peds GI at that point if we're still having issues.
And as you're trying to stop it, I think one important reminder he made was like, you need to taper it. You can't just stop these abruptly. And that's something, honestly, that is applicable for adults as well. You have the risk of rebound acid secretion and worsening of symptoms. All right. Well, that was a rapid fire review of reflux. I think the next time we're going to need to come up with a pun for each of these reflux things that we can use it for a seamless transition. But instead, I'm just going to very not seamlessly say,
hey, Cripsiders listeners, we're back with another sponsor. This is all about Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Freed was built for clinicians by their significant others. Gabby, a family med physician, and Erez, a computer engineer, are married. Erez built Freed so Gabby could stop charting over the weekends. It was one of those selfish presents that you simply get for yourself. Freed is an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you instantly. Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patient instructions. Charting is done before your patient even walks out of the room. Freed learns your style over time, just like any human scribe, and most importantly, it is HIPAA compliant. So you can try 10 notes for free, and after that, it only costs $99 per month. Better yet, Cripsiders listeners can get $50 off that first month. So, Try Freed for free right now by going to getfreed.ai. That's GETFREE.AI. And listeners of Cribsiders can use code CRIB50 for $50 off that first month.
Cleo, you want to tell us something about celiac?
Yes, I loved this episode. This was episode number 89. Our guest was Dr. Dale Lee, and the episode was produced by Dr. Angela Zhang. This was a really thoughtful discussion about celiac and the ways it can present, the ways that we think about testing both with serologic markers and in endoscopic evaluations, and then thinking about red flags and risks of celiac and our four pillars of monitoring. So in general, Dr. Lee outlined sort of the classic presentation of a young patient with a distended abdomen and some diarrheal symptoms. But what I thought was really striking was the discussion about how many symptoms can be more subtle and not so straightforward, like subtle constipation, some abdominal pain that we're able to ignore, or some rash, poor growth being an important marker. These are all really helpful presentations to think about when considering celiac.
With that in mind, it is helpful to think about the typical age of presentation, recognizing that there are so many nonspecific symptoms. So certainly at any age it can present, with the one exception being that you can't have celiac disease symptoms before gluten is introduced. So in the extremely young children where you aren't yet introducing solid foods, you really wouldn't be having it. But otherwise, it could be at any age. That said, it has a bimodal distribution, and the main age range of presentation is usually in that 8 to 10-year-old, and then again in around age 30 to 40.
Yeah. And Dr. Lee was really saying, because this can be so, the range can be so wide, that you really should maintain a low threshold to test for celiac.
Yeah, I think I ought to be testing some more patients than I have been in my own practice. When unsure about some GI symptoms, I'm wondering if it might be okay to go ahead and test. The other thing that I didn't think about at all was how it runs in families. At least 10%, he said, of celiac patients are asymptomatic. And so it's recommended that first degree relatives, so brothers or sisters, should get testing.
Super interesting. And thinking about testing, it was sort of an alphabet soup thinking about all these different markers for a serologic testing of celiac, really emphasizing that we reach for IgA and TTG testing because this is 95% sensitive and specific for celiac. Keeping in mind that we cannot use the TTG if the IgA is low, but he also talked about anti-gliadin and anti-mesial antibodies, which are not what we reach for in our primary care settings, but can be helpful for other reasons. Like the anti-mesial antibodies can be helpful in making a serologic diagnosis if that's positive and if the TGG is elevated more than 10 times the upper limit of normal, which I thought was really interesting.
I thought it was interesting that he kind of made this distinction between a serological, like the serologic diagnostic criteria in Europe versus what is used in the US. And he was saying that in Europe, there is a guideline that allows a serologic diagnosis to be made. So without an endoscopy, if you do have that exceptional elevation of the TTG along with one of the other antibodies, and that he was saying that, you know, he doesn't necessarily use this in most patients, but that is an option that he will offer and will do some shared decision making around, especially in a patient where the pretest probability is high, there's already a family history, et cetera.
That's so good. I love hearing ways that practice patterns differ and hearing ways that are like situations where the evidence to support just serologic testing is good and the evidence to support endoscopic testing as well is good and allowing you to make that clinical decision. What do we have to think about with endoscopic testing? And what does that diagnosis look like?
You know, it's interesting. I think the biggest learning pearl for me when they were talking about endoscopy and the diagnosis of celiac disease was making sure that a patient was currently exposed to gluten at the time of endoscopy. And so there was a big emphasis in the discussion about getting a patient who has positive serologies for celiac into a pediatric GI with relative in a few weeks, just so that the patient isn't stopping gluten, then they're unable to have a clear diagnosis on endoscopy either. And so I think that was really, really interesting too.
And Cleo, that's just the upper endoscopy, right? Is that all they need? Is just that look at the duodenal bulb?
Yes. Yep. That's all. I think he walked us through where he biopsies specifically, but focusing in the small intestine there.
Cleo, can you tell us a little bit about some of the symptoms and signs that would really make us more concerned for this beyond just, oh, some nonspecific abdominal pain or constipation?
Yes, there were certain symptoms that Dr. Lee talked about that would be more concerning. So a patient who's falling off the growth chart, someone who's having frequent bone fractures, and someone who has persistent abdominal pain or loose stools. Without other explanations, these are people to be thinking about celiac in. And what was interesting is that sort of ties into the discussion about the risks of patients who have ongoing active celiac disease. So those who have not eliminated gluten and are continuing to have issues, this celiac can impact their ability to absorb nutrients and grow. It affects bone mineralization and increases the risk of fractures, just what we discussed, and interestingly increases the risk of small bowel malignancies. I believe he mentioned lymphoma in that case. So important things to think about with active ongoing celiac disease.
Yeah. Honestly, the one thing that I thought was, oh my goodness, wait, that's the skin rash, right? And I actually just Googled the skin rash that I always forget is the dermatitis herpetiformis, the one that sounds like it's really it sounds like it's herpes virus, but it's not. It's dermatitis herpetiformis, and it's the celiac rash.
I'm pretty sure he didn't talk about that, though.
Ah, dang it.
But it's okay. You're giving us teaching points beyond it.
Extra credit. But what they did talk about was the management of celiac and really thinking about maintaining a rigorous gluten-free diet. It was interesting when he was talking about cross-contact or cross-contamination, a conversation I hadn't really thought about previously. Sydney, can you remind me what he talked about with cross-contact and celiac?
Yeah, so he had a couple of points with regards to cross-contact. The first one is just a kind of child-friendly note, which is that he made the point that calling something cross-contamination makes the idea sound incredibly scary and that we're really not trying to make a kid feel like, oh my God, someone's contaminating their food. And so cross-contact is a lot more of a child-friendly approach. And he also feels like it makes kids not feel like, oh my goodness, this is the huge boogeyman, while providing some amount of seriousness around it. That said, it is important that it's something that families, schools, et cetera, are educated on, because it does cause that same reaction, even if it's just something like having a spoon in the peanut butter after it's been in the bread. You're going to start to have that gluten that is affecting the child. And so this includes contact between utensils and food, also things in food preparation, and that you can, even when you're talking with schools, there's things that you can do to try to help set them up for success.
Yeah, I think this is where we can be such great advocates for our patients, helping patients set up 504 plans with their schools. He was very adamant, and I totally agree with this point. Schools are mandated to provide gluten-free food. We can set up situations for patients and for students in school to have success in their diagnosis, or rather in their treatment, when they're home and when they're away. For me, I feel like this is an area of focus for inclusion and making sure everybody has great access to what's really a treatment for this disease and a treatable disease ultimately.
I agree. And Dr. Lee then outlined some pillars of monitoring for celiac once you have a diagnosis and once patients are maintaining a gluten-free diet. First, he said the first pillar is monitoring symptoms. So what the patient presented with, how those symptoms are doing, and monitoring their weight and linear growth over time. The second pillar is lab monitoring the changes in the TTG, IgA titers over time. And then third, having patients have formal assessments with dietitians to monitor how they're doing maintaining a gluten-free diet. And then the fourth being an optional route is repeat assessment with endoscopy to see like microscopically how we're doing with managing the celiac.
Sydney, you asked for a pun, you get two. That was a fantastic way to gain some knowledge. We should move on to constipation though.
All right, I'm expecting even better to wrap us up after the constipation section.
Yeah. Oh, no, it'll get stuck there.
Oh, no.
Guess who's back again? It's Factor, ready to offer Cribsiders listeners even more discounts. So I've been using Factor and can't say enough good things about it. If you haven't checked out Factor Meals yet, Factor offers delicious, ready-to-eat meals delivered right to your doorstep. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. And also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and fueled good every single day. So Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. Meals can be ready in as little as 2 minutes. So, Cribsiders listeners, head to factormeals.com/cribsiders50 and use code cribsiders50 to get 50% off. That's code cribsiders50 at factormeals.com/cribsiders50 to get 50% off.
Let's move on without further ado then to our last one, which is constipation. This was episode 66 with our guest, Dr. Peter Liu. I actually produced this one. It's kind of funny that I'm now leading the conversation on it again. I guess I just can't get enough of the constipation. I loved this conversation with Dr. Liu. So many practical tips. My biggest one is just establishing a good diagnosis for constipation and seeing what the patient looks like when they present. He highlighted the Rome 4 constipation criteria for rather functional constipation, which is 2 bowel movements a week or less, an episode or more of fecal incontinence, withholding or large caliber pain, or rather large caliber stool or pain.
I think that one thing that he mentioned a couple times that really stood out to me is that the fecal incontinence is very, very much a piece to be looking for. This is one of the most impactful symptoms. It's also something that is a little bit more specific for constipation and really something that you should be asking about and looking for. The other thing that he talked about with the diagnosis that to me was very reassuring and a little bit practice changing is the fact that it doesn't have to be a diagnosis of exclusion. It can be a functional constipation can be the presumptive diagnosis in the absence of red flag symptoms, meaning that you don't have to go down this full workup when the presentation fits the criteria for functional constipation.
Absolutely. And I think it was in the beginning of this episode when Chris asked about the Bristol stool chart. And I appreciated this question because I can't tell you how many times I've pulled up this chart, like spent time pulling up this chart in clinic. And I've wondered to myself, how helpful is this? And it turns out it's not incredibly helpful. It's used more in like research studies, it sounds like. But the important piece is asking about hard stools, dry stools, and understanding sort of what the stools look like.
I loved that they both were talking about comparing it to things like vegetables.
Oh, yeah. And mashed potatoes and applesauce. That was practice changing knowledge for me right there. So I think when we're talking about constipation and how it presents, it seems to me like it's not kind of a disorder of the gut-brain interaction in the way we think about IBS, but more a pattern or cycle often in children and especially in toddlers of withholding that leads to pain, that leads to more withholding. It's almost like a mechanistic and troublesome cycle for kids. With that in mind, the 3 times for constipation were highlighted: when adding solid foods or really advancing the diet, when potty training, which makes sense because kids might be scared of the big potty, or when starting school. I tried to teach a little bit on constipation the other day with a medical student who's in clinic with me, and they mentioned maybe having a new sibling as a time for constipation or something like that. And that was the other thing that Dr. Liu highlighted is really any time of increased stress, like having a new sibling or maybe there's a custody change, things like that, can manifest as a behavioral change, which then snowballs into an issue of constipation. Mm. Cleo, would you mind remind us of those red flags before we get too far away and too into the functional constipation realm?
Absolutely. So they outlined a few red flags symptoms for constipation, thinking about very early onset constipation, needing to rule out positional or structural causes of constipation. Constipation that's associated with poor weight gain, important to think about celiac disease again, and then thyroid screens for these patients. And then those who are, you know, you feel may be functional constipation and then are just not responding to the typical treatment that you reach for.
Yeah, it sounded like there's a little bit of a few categories for those can't miss diagnoses, the babies or the congenital issues like Hirschsprung's or like the spinal cord things that you mentioned. And then the school age kids, some of the can't miss changes, like he mentioned perianal Crohn's causing withholding, causing constipation, or tenesmus. That's something I'd never heard of. I thought that was fascinating.
So thinking a little bit, kind of circling back to, okay, you have someone who's presenting with symptoms that are more suggestive of functional constipation. We should get an abdominal x-ray in all of these patients, right, Brian?
Oh, all the time. Every patient gets an abdominal x-ray. Not true. This was one where I think Justin tried to throw Chris under the bus. Yeah, I loved the idea of finding a reasonable use of the abdominal x-ray. I went into this episode thinking that it was going to be a resounding no, but I think there is, from what I heard from Dr. Liu, a reasonable case for an abdominal x-ray. Something like the differential is a little bit beyond functional constipation, or you have other reasons to look for stool in there. But overall, everybody in the human race at some point in time will have stool on their abdominal x-ray. And so really relying on the history is more useful for diagnosis. I think we've nailed diagnosis, and I would love to move on to treatment because there are some great pearls. And I think there's so much that we can do before the patient gets to GI in terms of treatment. The first thing that I wanted to touch on is this idea of fiber and fluid. I thought also going into this episode, we should increase fiber, we should increase fluid. But it sounds like what's more appropriate and what's actually evidence-based is not too much, not too little. A Goldilocks approach to having some fiber, some fluid. The issue might arise though, we've got, you know, a kid coming to the clinic and their normal amount of fiber, quote unquote, is really like one or two veggies a day. And we should try to establish a normal, healthy, balanced diet with fruits and veggies at a reasonable rate for kids.
And Dr. Liu reminded us of some great sources of fiber in our diet, including apples, prunes, but most importantly for my learning, kiwis. Apparently, they have a very large source of fiber.
I knew a man who ate a kiwi with the skin on it, with the peach fuzz on it.
With the kiwi fuzz.
With the kiwi fuzz.
That's going to be the 2024 yeah. color of the year.
We're already in 2024, Cleo.
Oh.
So then going from managing with kind of your very, very conservative, which is establishing a good amount of fiber and fluid, not too much, not too little, the management broke again down by age. I heard that for infants, you can actually change the formula. So a second episode where changing the formula is actually a reasonable approach. Thinking again about some allergies, I think changing formula for me had a bad rap before some of these episodes. And then for younger kids, there's some great use for some of these smaller volume laxatives like lactulose or milk of magnesia.
Thinking about these younger kids, one thing he said for me that honestly is pretty practice changing is he was saying that there's actually not evidence that cutting down on milk or eliminating it helps with functional constipation, which is so interesting to me because I think one of the first things I ask every time is how much milk are they drinking? And it could just be that milk is, in many of these cases, it's taking the place of fiber, to Brian's point on that a lot of people, their baseline for fiber is just inadequate. But it does kind of make the case that, okay, if we're going purely based on the evidence, you shouldn't necessarily be focusing on making sure they only get, say, 24 ounces of milk a day.
And then for older kids, I think the introduction of PEG 3350 is the mainstay of treatment. There's great evidence behind that as your go-to. It's cheap, it's effective, it hides well in juices or water or other things like applesauce.
And importantly, it's also something that patients can titrate at home. They can adjust how much they're mixing in to help titrate to their goal stool output.
I feel like polyethylene glycol and then those stimulant laxatives are things that I became less shy about after this episode. Dr. Liu also touched on bisacodyl and senna, our stimulant laxatives, as helping us move things forward, especially in patients who are maybe withholding. He mentioned that families might have the preconceived notion that this is going to make the gut lazy, but really there's no evidence to support this. And initiating some senna in a patient with no red flags who maybe isn't quite cutting it on a half a cap of PEG 3350 or might need some extra push is a great option to do.
And safe.
Yeah, and safe.
And not only all those other wonderful benefits, but if you don't do that, that's really where you're going to start running into problems, to the point on this withholding, hard stool, painful to pass, losing nerve, the sensation of needing to stool, all of those things kind of go together. So you being a little more aggressive with treatment was kind of one of my big takeaways from this, specifically aggressive with the use of PEG 3350 and those stimulant laxatives. And to that point, Dr. Liu mentioned that there are some new meds that especially the GI specialists are starting to use. But really, if you're dealing with a functional constipation picture, if you use the adequate amounts, the softener and stimulant combination should work. However, no Docusate. That was kind of a big thing that I was like, okay, I just need to like remove this from the med list because he said there's really no role for it.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Cleo, at the time of kind of moving through some of these osmotic laxatives, stimulant laxatives, staying away from Docusate, who did you hear needed pediatric GI?
It's really when they're not improving with the behavioral change strategies that you're treating with a stool softener, and ideally, in most cases, at least one stimulant. At that point, you can talk to your local pediatric GI and reach out for additional assistance.
Yeah, I think some other places for assistance is in neurodivergent patients. Sydney, did you hear anything about that?
Yeah, I thought this was a really amazing point. It's just kind of in general thinking about how patients may present differently and when the treatment strategies need to be a little bit different. And he made the point that in neurodivergent patients, first of all, constipation is a pretty frequent sign, a pretty frequent thing that people are dealing with, and that you may need to think differently about solutions. One thing he pointed out to me that I hadn't really considered is that some people with autism spectrum disorder tend to be what he called super tasters. And so even though PEG 3350, sorry to all the people out there that are now going to think that I'm sponsored by Big Miralax. I promise I'm not. but all the that they say that it has no taste, but that there are many patients with autism spectrum disorder are not necessarily they can tell when it's there and don't tolerate it as well, and that there's some other good options, including the chewable senna preparations that have more of a chocolate taste and texture might be a better option.
Yeah, absolutely. So with all of this, in terms of who to sum it up, we refer to GI. It's the patients who aren't getting better at the top end of those dosing. And the dosing guidelines are put together in NASPGHAN's kind of cumbersome figure. This was my last take-home point, is how hilarious it was, Chris and Justin kind of roasting the NASPGHAN figure. But there is some helpful things in there, like those dosing guidelines. I think the place where the dosing guidelines don't apply are the patients who are getting inpatient cleanouts. And then the goal, it seems like, of inpatient cleanouts is to get patients rid of this stool ball or this large caliber stool in their rectum, and getting them onto some of this outpatient management that we talked about with the polyethylene glycol 3350 with some senna or bisacodyl on board.
All right. Wow. We did it. I don't know if we have a good pun to wrap ourselves up, but I did just ask ChatGPT to write us a limerick. So how do you feel about that?
Yes. Let's hear it, Sydney.
All right. So this is ChatGPT's very short limerick that I have not yet read. So you're hearing it the same time as I am literally reading it. So first of all, I would like to read their introduction. Certainly. Here's a limerick about pediatric GI disorders. There once was a tummy so small. In kids, it had troubles and all. GI disorders did play, but doctors found a way to bring health back with care overall.
Oh!
A tummy so small. It's so cute.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Our showrunner for this show has been Sam Mazur. Big thanks to our social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I've been Brian Ward.
I've been Cleo Rochat.
And I've been Sydney Engel. Thank you and good night.